Nella puntata di oggi ascoltiamo Ken Loach, regista e sceneggiatore di fama mondiale, che ha tenuto la sua lezione dottorale l'11 novembre 2025 in collegamento da Londra, in occasione del conferimento della laurea d'onore in scienze filosofiche dell'Università di Bologna. Buon ascolto!
Well, this is immensely kind and generous of this university, Bologna, of which I'm a very proud member. So thank you. And thank you to those who have spoken and said such generous things, immensely kind. I can't live up to them. I wish I could, but at least thank you. And also, I must thank you for speaking in English. I mean, this is a huge courtesy to someone, to people who I'm joining an Italian university, and you are speaking from Italy, and you speak English. And thank you for that. And excuse me if I, just for the moment, take off the hat. Because it'll overheat my brain. Thank you. I shall wear it on many occasions. Thank you. Well, I was wondering what I might say while I was sitting there. And I think I would try to share some moments of good fortune and some critical moments over the last 60 years of filmmaking, and why we have come to this point, both in work and in the world we live in, and to say what has helped to shape my point of view, and maybe also the way you see the world too. It starts in the 1960s, in the 60s, and after a few years in the theatre, not very successful, and I found myself in the BBC with a young family to support, so I had to get a job, and I was directing plays at the BBC, and I joined a group who were given the task of making contemporary drama. Films about, or programs about today. And we started to tell stories of ordinary people. We changed from studio drama to filming in the streets, because that's where the stories were. And then once we started making films, I had to realize I didn't know how to make them. I just didn't know. And I began, and the films that struck me the most were the Italian films after the war, that told great stories. And they the great achievement for me was that it made it clear that the working class was a subject for film. Because we were used to see middle-class people, people who spoke posh, aristocrats, people with servants, and the Italian films taught me that the working class could be heroes. And that was a great lesson. So then we started to learn really how to make films. And it came clear to me that the camera can see who you are. It can see your skin. It can see how you have lived. It can see if you work with your hands. It can see what your diet is. Do you eat well? Do you eat bad food? How has your body changed by work? The skin on your hands. How you talk, how you use language, your jokes, your relationships, everything about you. And so we thought, well, we have to work with ordinary people. We have to find real people. Again, something we learned from the Italians. But just when we were making this, a whole other strand of life appeared. Because the 60s was a time for the new left. The new left. And their slogan was, neither Washington nor Moscow. In other words, not the Stalinist oppression in the East, nor the brutal capitalist exploitation in the West. Neither Washington nor Moscow. And we read books, and we learned street politics, we stood on picket lines, and we were part of that movement. But one thing, my memory is not good, but one thing has stayed with me all my life. And that was this, the basic analysis. And it is this, that there's a conflict, a split, runs right through our society. It is the conflict between those who sell their labor, and it is the conflict between those who profit from it. Those who sell their labor and those who make money from them. And the conflict is eternal, it is irreconcilable, and it will go on until we win. And that's true today, as it was true yesterday in the 60s, and it has been true since the Industrial Revolution began. That's the conflict. And everything that we have learned since then comes from that conflict. And then to make films, and we realize that politics doesn't live in making, you can't make films about slogans. You have to make films about people. And politics lives in people. It is their experiences. It is their struggles. It is their relationships. It is in their sadness. It's in their anger. It's in their suffering. But it's also in their laughter. It's in their laughter and in their jokes and in the fact how they get on with each other and how they survive. And finding stories that our aim was always to provide stories where you tell one small story, a relationship, a family. And in that, just tell that story, and it clarifies the whole contradictions in society. You don't need to make a speech about it. Just tell that story of those people, and that clarifies the world we're in. That was our aim. And here I must say the importance of the writing. I'm not a writer. I don't make films on my own. I always work with others, and particularly the writer. And the writers I've worked with have been magnificent, and Grace, and I learned from them. And the one I've worked with for 30 years, Paul Laverty, is a great friend and comrade. And they are his films as much as they are mine. But then, of course, we had to work how to create stories that seemed spontaneous, that were people were vulnerable, people touched you, people felt a new level of reality. These people are really happy. This is happening in front of the camera. And we recognize their humanity. And that was our aim. And the camera becomes like an observer in the corner of the room with the eyes like the eyesight that we have. Not too big that you see more than you would see in real life. Not so tiny that your eyes don't work like that. So the lenses, the camera, and the light are inside to what we would really see in real life. And I could talk for a long time about this, but just to be really quick, the other thing I found is absolutely central, and that is that when you make films, There has to be a sense of enjoyment. There has to be a sense of mutual respect, a sense where everyone is comfortable, respected, given credit, knows they can make themselves vulnerable. This is the key thing, be vulnerable and not be mocked or laughed at, but respected. And it is the director's job to ensure that. And on a wet day, when the electrician is outside the window, holding a lamp that looks like sunlight, every now and then, it's the director's job to go outside and say, are you okay? You want a cup of tea? How are you getting on? So you stay in touch, you know, and you are one team. And there is no hierarchy. And no one has a special car. And no one has a seat with a name on, as in the movies. And we are one team. And the other thing the director, I think, has to do is to say to an actor, someone in the film who's never been in a film before is nervous, to say, I will make more mistakes than you do, which is true. I will make more mistakes than you do, so don't worry. It's just film that goes through a camera. And I think if you can generate that spirit, then all is well. And we were lucky, and we carried on and made a number of films. And then fast forward to the 80s, and to spend a brief time here, because the 80s was a decade of defeat. Decade of defeat. In our country, we elected a hard right government led by Margaret Thatcher. And her aim was to restore profit to business. They weren't making enough money. They've got to make more. How do you do it? Make labor cheaper. How do you do that? Attack the unions. Create unemployment. Drive down wages, and key, defeat the unions in strikes you provoke. And the big battle was the miners' strike, and the government won. And this is the lesson. There were two lessons from the 80s. One is the ruling class is ruthless. They don't care about your suffering. They don't care about destroying communities. They don't care about bringing poverty. Their bottom line is profit. That's it. They're ruthless. And the other lesson is that the parties of the what they call in our country, I don't know if they call them this in Italy, centre-left, we call them the Labour Party. I think in Europe they call them socialists. Socialists, well, I think not. They will never reflect the interests of the working class, because they believe in making capitalism work. And remembering that first principle, that's the split between the ruling class and the working class. And that has been borne out ever since, in my experience. And in the miners' strike, the labor leaders turned their back on the miners. A great act of betrayal. So another lesson. And now we come to the present day. And the present day is the most dangerous, desperate, terrible times. And I think we all feel that the security such as it was, not very secure, but some security, is disappearing. The world is fracturing in front of us. People feel threatened, endangered, insecure. There have been new ways found to exploit working people. Insecure work, contracts have gone. Okay, you're working today, you're not working tomorrow. Poverty, hunger. I don't know what it is like in your country, but in our country, something unthinkable is now happening, that many families will not eat and let's say you put an extra tin of food at the supermarket into a bag. There are many other ways of people being supported by charity food. That was unthinkable 15 years ago, and now it is the reality. And nobody comments. Nobody comments. People starve without charity. In the thing, the seventh richest country in the world, and that is our society now. And the inequality is stark. Huge fortunes taken out of the country, and poverty, inequality, housing that covers many classes, middle class families, where young people will find nowhere to live, to live with their parents much longer. There is an imbalance, there's a discontent, there's a rage, there's a disillusion amongst young people, older people, a rage. I've never known anything like it. And of course, as we have warned for decades, the far right cash in. The far right are with us again. What we thought we would never see. Fascism on the streets again. Or people who are so close to fascists. Maybe not fascists, but they use the tactics of fascists. And we see it in our country, we see it in the States, where the anger and the disillusion is exploited, is developed. People are made more angry, more disillusioned with what has happened. And of course, the other tactic is to find a scapegoat, someone to blame, and it will be someone poorer than even the poorest people in our country, the most vulnerable, with nothing at all. And that is the tactics of those who are so close to fascists, it's hard not to call them fascists. And we see it in our country now. And it is frightening. We see mobs on the streets who are not all right wingers bred in their bones. There are people who've been whipped up to this. Threatened one case, threatened to put on fire a hotel in which migrants were living. She was punished for it. But there are many threats. Many throwing stones. We never thought we would ever see that again. Yet it is happening. And it is happening across Europe. It is happening on the States. It is happening across the world. Even in South America, some countries. That's at home. Abroad, we see the terrible threat of climate change. An existential threat for humanity, where we are consciously destroying the fabric of the planet we live on. And we are doing it. And of course the science is there, and it's in all our universities. We all know it. And yet there are idiot politicians who say, drill, baby, drill. And they are destroying us. And this is a situation in which the intellectuals and people of good conscience have to speak up, as I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. The universities do. Must speak up. Because, again, people are misled. People have been elected. We know the President of the United States has said, it's a myth. And the danger of this is just incredible when you see what the predictions are for people whose land will disappear, the species that will disappear. And it is happening now. And we all have that responsibility to stand together in solidarity, to make certain science wins, knowledge wins. Because it's what we have, is our knowledge, our science, our intellectual capacity. And then, of course, wars and all that follows. and we see it in Ukraine, and we see it in the Sudan, which is terrible, and we see it in Gaza and Palestine and in Israel. And of course, that is terrifying. And what is extraordinary, because you think, well, we look around and say, where's the moment of hope? Where's hope? My God, we've got to live, you know? This is a world we are passing on to the young people that you teach, that we are, you know, our time as custodians of the planet has been pretty poor, really. I think we should get sent down from university for our stewardship of the planet. But such as it is, we have this terrible, terrible war that we have seen. And what marks out, to me, the war in Israel-Palestine and the war against the Palestinians in Gaza is this. It has now gone on for 2 years, with years and years of illegal occupation, settler occupation, theft of land, military occupation, illegal, illegality after illegality, allowed, tolerated by Western governments, tolerated, some wanton killing with impunity. But now, in the last 2 years, and what has happened from October 23 onwards, is just something we thought we would never see again, like some of the other things we've talked about. Never see again. We never thought we would see a genocide again. And that's simply intolerable. But I say, what marks this out for me is that my country is sending weapons still to a state that has internationally, the international bodies that have spoken, and spoken with great authority, an association of International Association of Genocide Academics, I believe, and the United Nations Commission of Inquiry has also something came the same conclusion, that Israel's actions amount to the legal definition of genocide. Those are the highest bodies in the world that have spoken. Not the courts yet, but they have. And their conclusion is unanswerable. They've checked the laws. It is genocide. And my country here is selling weapons to the country committing genocide. And that is a shame on both of us, on all of us here. I can't speak for Italy. But it is something we should see with absolute shame. Our country is breaking the Genocide Convention, which is a legal obligation to prevent genocide. They are not doing it. They are breaking the law. Where's international law? Where's the protection of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Where is it? Broken, shattered by politicians it's not stupidity. It's cynical collusion in a war crime of the greatest proportions. And that's our government today. And we should be deeply ashamed. And every state that falls into that category should also be deeply ashamed. Because we've all seen the pictures. We've all seen the pictures, the starving, the dead, the mourning, people buried under the rubble, desperate parents, operations without things to, what do you call it, when you numb the flesh, anesthetics, weapons, amputations without anesthetics. And we are colluding in that. Shame on this country, and shame on the country, other countries in Europe who will go along with it, and most shame to the United States that is funded this whole grisly operation. What can we do? Well, it is It has created the biggest international support than any other issue of the times. And that is a moment of hope, because mass demonstrations saying this cannot continue, calling for the rule of law, simply the rule of law. This cannot continue. And it is across the world. And students have played a leading part. And well done, I say congratulations to them. And universities have played a leading part. And I think we have to be absolutely rigorous in how we interpret our duty, which is to absolutely cut academic ties. It's a peaceful way of showing where we stand. We simply must do it. Likewise, artists of all kinds should do it too. And many do. Artists, musicians, writers in theatre, painters, poets, many of them speak out. And also, I have to say, sadly, a lot of filmmakers don't, and they should. Some don't. Some do, and some in much higher place in the industry than me, but they do, and well done to them. And I think that's, if we have one cause that will unite us, that will bring solidarity, then that is our cause. But we must also remember the social causes, the poverty, the inequality, where we live in a world of riches, and we could live so much better if we lived, if we shared what we own. Common ownership, democratic control, the real change, end that conflict of the classes. If we protected our planet, of course we could. We have the knowledge, we have the passion, we care. Let's do it. Let's do it. And I have one message to my new friends in Bologna, my respected friends, is please, can I be part of the way you fight it back too? Because solidarity is our strength, and our knowledge and our passion are our weapons. And if I can end with one quote, if I can remember it, from Paul Robeson, the great black singer of the 30s, 40s, 50s, a wonderful singer, but also politically absolutely committed. And if I can remember it offhand, it is artists, it's applied to university lecturers and professors and the ones who know, the intellectual leaders, should apply to them too. Artists are the gatekeepers of truth. They are civilization's radical voice. Let's be that in our universities, in our arts, and at the workplace too. And in the schools, and wherever we work, in our communities, wherever we live, wherever we work. Let's be the voice of truth. It's a huge honor to be here. I've spoken far too long. I'd state my welcome. But thank you so much. It's such an honor. And I'm looking forward to wearing the hat again. Thank you.
Avete ascoltato Ken Loach, regista e sceneggiatore di fama mondiale, che ha tenuto la sua lezione dottorale l'11 novembre 2025 in collegamento da Londra, in occasione del conferimento della laurea ad honorem in scienze filosofiche dell'Università di Bologna. Vi aspettiamo alla prossima Alma Lectio!